Chapter 20, the last chapter. In Savannah, there would be little, if any, celebrating during this holiday season, not with the Yankee invaders on the city's very doorstep. Corey stood on the rear second-floor balcony of the Heffy home and trained a pair of field glasses to the south of the city. Although he couldn't actually see any of the Yankees, he saw smoke rising into the sky from their campfires. They were taking life easy down there, he thought, taking their own sweet time about getting ready to move on the city. So far, there had been no attacks. The only communication from the enemy had been a message from Sherman to Hardy demanding that Savannah be surrendered without delay. If not, Sherman wrote, he would feel justified in resorting to the harshest measures. Corey had seen the message himself, and when he read it, he felt like crumpling the paper into a ball or ripping it into shreds. Neither action would change a damn thing, he knew. Like the gentleman he was, Hardy had been restrained in his response to Sherman's blunt ultimatum. He had declined to surrender, of course, and had subtly chided Sherman for his bluster. That might put a bee in the Yankees' bonnet, Corey thought, but it seemed unlikely that Hardy's refusal to surrender could make the situation any worse than it already was. Hardy sat behind Corey in a wicker armchair.
"Any news of the enemy's movements?"
he asked in a voice little more than a murmur. "No, sir. We have good scouts posted to keep watch on the Yankees. I'm sure we'll hear mighty quick if they start to move against us."
"I imagine they'll make an announcement when they commence action, probably to the accompaniment of their artillery."
Corey lowered the glasses. "Yes, sir, I expect so. A continual bombardment had worked at Vicksburg. It would work here just as well." Footsteps clattered inside the house. The door to the balcony opened, and Abner stepped out.
"General Hardy, sir?"
But he was interrupted by a man pushing impatiently past him. Corey turned to see General Beauregard striding onto the balcony. Beauregard's face was dark with anger.
"General," he said to Hardy, "I see that the pontoon bridges across the river are still not completed."
As Corey had expected, Hardy had ordered the engineers to build a bridge across the Savannah River. The work had barely gotten started, however.
"General, my men have begun the construction work," Hardy began.
"Not good enough. They must be done and done quickly."
Corey had gotten to know Hardy fairly well. He could tell that Beauregard's snappish tone angered the general. But good soldier that he was, Hardy merely nodded.
"Of course, sir. I intend to speak to the engineers myself." "As you wish."
Hardy looked at Corey.
"Lieutenant Brandon, accompany General Beauregard and provide him any assistance he may require."
Corey snapped to attention and saluted. He suspected that Hardy was sending him along so the engineers would know that the general was acceding to Beauregard's wishes. The real reason Hardy had dragged his feet about the bridges, Corey thought, was because at heart the general was a fighting man. Building those bridges meant that the city's defenders were going to evacuate Savannah, give it up without a fight. That stuck in Hardy's craw. Corey understood completely. He didn't like the idea either. Yet from a strategic point of view, Beauregard was right. If the Confederates stayed where they were, they faced a battle that was unwinnable. It was all right to hope for a miracle. Sometimes miracles actually happened. But with Robert E. Lee's army pinned down at Petersburg and Hood off somewhere in Tennessee, no one was left to deliver such a miracle. Hardy was on his own here in Savannah, facing a strong, well-fed, well-supplied foe. Outnumbered 6-1, ultimately the defenders had no chance. They might fight to the last man, but in the end every one of them would either die or be captured. Beauregard stalked off the balcony. Corey followed, jerking his head at Abner to indicate that the sergeant was to accompany him. Along with members of Beauregard's staff, they walked down to the riverfront with the general. When they got there, Beauregard lit into the engineers, barking orders, striding back and forth, and making suggestions to speed up the process of bridge building. Corey observed, somewhat in awe, as the pace of the work increased. Details of soldiers were sent to the plantations upriver, with orders to bring back as many rice boats as they could lay their hands on. These small, flat-bottomed boats, commonly used by workers in the flooded rice fields, were given an extra layer of caulking then positioned to serve as makeshift pontoons. Heavy wheels from railroad cars were attached to them to serve as anchors and keep them in place. Meanwhile, more gangs of slaves and laborers were charged with tearing down warehouses and other buildings along the river. The lumber obtained by this demolition was brought to the site and laid across the pontoons. Before Corey's eyes, the bridges began to take shape.
"Ain't much for looks," Abner said. "But as long as they'll float and hold up a fella's weight, I reckon they'll do."
The bridges would have to support more than just a man's weight. They would have to hold up under the burden of thousands of men, marching across them as they fled the city. The mile-wide span of the Savannah River was broken by two long, narrow islands that divided the river into channels. Hutchinson's Island was closest to the city, so the first pontoon bridge was built to it from the foot of West Broad Street. Upon reaching Hutchinson's Island, the troops would march across the sandy ground and then use another bridge to get to Pennyworth Island. The third bridge would reach from Pennyworth Island to the South Carolina shore. Using the islands as stepping stones, the engineers were able to complete the bridges in 3 days, under the nearly continual prodding of Beauregard. Meanwhile, in order to mask the evacuation plans and induce Sherman to believe that the defenders intended to make a fight of it, Hardy ordered the big guns around the city to open a bombardment on the Union lines. The Yankees answered in kind, sending shells whistling into the city. None of them did much damage, however. Yankee skirmishers approached the defensive line and traded rifle shots with the Confederate pickets. No real battles broke out, but there was a constant racket in the air as cannons boomed and riflemen on both sides sniped at each other. By the morning of December 20th, the bridges across the river were ready. Corey and Abner looked on as a weary Hardy issued orders for the men along the defensive line to begin pulling back and concentrating along the riverfront. The troops that were already in town started moving down to the river first. The retreat across the river would not take place until that night, so that it could be covered by darkness. At dusk that evening, Hardy climbed to the balcony of the Heffy house and leaned his hands on the railing as he stared out at the campfires of the Yankees in the distance. The fires were becoming visible in the gathering shadows, although they wouldn't be for long, as fog rolled in from the ocean. Corey followed in time to hear the general murmur,
"I would have liked to give that man a tussle, but that will have to wait for another day."
Corey nodded.
"Yes, sir. And I anticipate that day will come soon enough."
Hardy smiled faintly. He was carrying his hat. Now, he settled it on his head.
"I expect you're right, Lieutenant."
He left the balcony, intending to go to the riverfront to supervise the evacuation of the troops. Corey would have followed on Hardy's heels, but Betty Heffy stepped out to block his path with a worried expression on her face.
"Lieutenant Brannan," she asked, "what's to become of us here in Savannah?"
Corey tried to sound reassuring.
"Well, the Yankees have no reason to do anything against the city. I believe they will treat you all decently, Mrs. Heffy."
But that man, Sherman."
Corey knew what she meant. As the various companies of Georgia militia had been driven back to Savannah by the relentless federal advance, they had brought with them stories of the horrible devastation wreaked by Sherman's men. Across a swath of Georgia 60 miles wide, hardly a building was left standing. They had all been burned, as had the fields on every farm and plantation. The cattle that had not been slaughtered to feed Sherman's troops had been murdered out of sheer spite, along with all the horses, mules, and pigs. By and large, the soldiers had spared the lives of the civilians they encountered, but that was all they spared. Everything else was gone, destroyed. So Betty Heffy had every right to worry, Corey thought. But he was convinced that Sherman would not lay waste to Savannah, as he had the rest of Georgia.
"You don't have to worry," he told her. "The Yankees want this port. They won't destroy it. They'll just occupy Savannah, like they did Vicksburg. I was there, you know, after the city was surrendered. It wasn't that bad.